Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Liberty Talk FM.
Good morning. Welcome to Medicine on Call. Today I have one of my favorite people on, Dr. Marilyn Singleton, and she is a member of the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons. She's an anesthesiologist by trade, an academician, a lawyer, and somebody who can speak with knowledge, with gravitas, and clearly about what's going on in Congress with this new American Healthcare Act, which, as we all know, as soon as they name something, it's usually the opposite of what they call it. It usually has the opposite effect. Dr. Singleton, thank you so much for getting up at the crack of dawn. I know you're in California, but I really needed your sage advice and wisdom on what's going on up there, because we keep hearing how awesome this thing is, that the House is just over the moon that they passed this, barely. And from my take, from reading it, it's not going to do what they say it's going to do. So I have one question to begin the show. Does it repeal Obamacare? Does it replace it? And in your opinion, is it better?
Okay, first of all, good morning, and so nice to talk with you again.
That's a pleasure.
It's been a while.
Yeah, I know.
Okay, the American Healthcare Act. No, it does not repeal Obamacare. First, let me start by saying one of the reasons it doesn't, and I'll be generous when I say this, is they could pass it because they want to use what's called the reconciliation process in the Senate, which only requires 51 votes, not 60, which is the usual. And what reconciliation is, you can only use it if the law that you're trying to pass deals with the budget and deals with financial things. So if to repeal Obamacare, since it had other things in it other than just financial things, would mean you couldn't use reconciliation. So that's why they had to do it this way. So, in fairness, that's why it was this way. But no, it does not repeal Obamacare. And in fact, when you read the American Healthcare Act, not very much has changed. So, some of the things that have changed, and again, these are things that can be financial, is they did repeal the individual mandate and the employer mandate to provide insurance. They kept most of the rules about having to issue insurance to anyone keeping children on till age 26, but they've moved some of that power to the states to be able to modify these things. Like the essential health benefits are in the federal law, but a state can get a waiver to change the so-called essential health benefits that include so many things that make health care expensive. But one of the things that's quite interesting is even though they removed the individual mandate, there's now a 30% surcharge if you had insurance and you let it lapse. So when you go to renew your lapse policy, you're going to get charged an extra 30%. So in some cases, that could be more than the individual mandate.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the tool that they're using to get people to keep their insurance rather than dealing with the IRS and turning in some money to them. So who can say what's better?
Well, from my take on an overall view, they've shifted. It's like a shell game. In the Affordable Care Act, it was the people within the policy, the young people specifically, that were bearing the brunt for the cost. They've taken it from them, and they've shifted it to the taxpayer, either the state or the federal taxpayer, in subsidies, in this, well, the bail-in or bail-out. I think this is a bailout for the insurance company. 30% surcharge is outrageous. What if you have no medical condition and you're totally healthy? Why do you have to pay 30% to an insurance company? So it's what they wanted from the get-go. Straight money, no matter what. And they don't have any risk. How do you, I'd love to run a business where I can just get money from the government for doing basically nothing and denying health care, which is what they do. We all know that as doctors. And now they're going to be paid for the privilege of, if there's a sick person, the government covers it. If the person can't afford the premium, the government covers it, meaning the taxpayer. What kind of system is this?
Well, the thing that's so crazy about it, what I find interesting is, no, you can't tell me that all the people who are speaking out against this mm-hmm. or who were speaking out for the Affordable Care Act actually knew anything that was in it. Nobody knows what's in this, and they're saying, oh, it's terrible. Well, at least read it and see if there's anything good in there before mm-hmm. you just uniformly say it's terrible just because the Republicans passed it.
Right.
Now, some of the good things in there were they expanded the health savings account benefit up to $6,500 for an individual that you could contribute tax-free and $13,000 for a family.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a good thing. That's getting on the track of saving your money for health issues. And that's tax-free. So, yes, in one sense, the government's paying for that because you didn't pay taxes on $6,500 or $13,000.
Right.
We pay tax on everything. This is the whole single-payer problem. I heard one of the pundits say that he believed in 7 years we would have a single-payer system.
Yeah.
And when people think, oh, boy, then it'll be free, well, of course it's not free.
Of course
you
not.
You have to tax. Out here in California, quite stuffily, and this is why I think your audience is great to listen to you and hear these things, where many things at your state level just kind of creep on through and people don't even know about it till there's some small line in the newspaper. And this wasn't even publicized, but they passed a 12 cents a gallon gas tax.
Ooh.
And that's supposed to help with the roads. Now, we all know it won't stay with the roads.
No.
Use it for whatever. But who does that hurt? That hurts the lower middle class. These are the people who have to commute to their jobs and, who work at Cost Plus or Ralph's or wherever and aren't making a huge amount of money and can't telecommute like the computer nerds can.
Mm-hmm.
And they're the ones who have to pay the extra 12 cents a gallon. But when people say, oh, good, now X, Y, or Z will happen, well, someone has paid for it. And in single payer, someone will pay for it, and it'll be everybody. And what we come down to with this proposed new law is the same old thing. People with chronic conditions cost money.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you deal with that? How much do you stick it to the young, healthy people to pay for the sick people? And certainly the group that people are focusing on without saying it because they say, oh, the old folks will be in ruins. Well, people over 65 will not be. Nothing changes in Medicare. It's if you happen to be 55 through 65, that's going to be the danger zone. You're more likely to be sick. Your premiums can go up. But what do you do? Where do you decide fair's fair? If you build a house on the banks of the Mississippi, you should have to buy flood insurance. The issue is, if you have a chronic illness, that's not your fault. You chose to live on the banks of the Mississippi, so you should pay more to insure your house.
Mm-hmm.
So then you get into the, well, it's not your fault if you have a chronic illness. Then you have to start parsing that. Well, sometimes it is. What do you do with somebody who's obese because they ate so much, or smoked cigarettes, or drank alcohol in excess? Then it is their fault. You know what? Healthcare, medical care, and these issues that involve social behavior are very difficult, and difficult to legislate. Because how can you write that in a law? But if you smoke, we aren't going to help with your health insurance premium.
It's a tough call.
It is a tough call because, I mean, personally, I remember sometimes in the OR anesthetizing a drug addict for a lot of kidney disease-related things, and they get kidney disease from injecting the drugs and all, and you think, oh, my goodness, you know, all of our state dollars are going to this guy who's going to go out and OD tomorrow. But that's what you do. You help people when you're in the medical field, and you're not supposed to be looking at what got them there. Well, they're just someone who's sick.
I mean, personal responsibility definitely comes into play, but to me, that's part of the problem. The other problem is the government putting its finger on the scale of this and trying to control everything centrally. If the free market were allowed to run, I don't believe health insurance would be as high as it is for anybody, whether they have a pre-existing or not. I don't believe the doctors would be running in droves out of the healthcare profession because they can barely, you know, keep their practices open, or they're so, you know, emotionally bereft that they're killing themselves. None of this stuff would go on. And if the system is allowed to work the way it's designed, it would find its own level. There would be an insurance company that exists for people with a lot of medical conditions, and they would get, you know, they'd pay better, maybe a higher rate for better care. I mean, everything would find its way, but when it's artificially designed and controlled, and to me, this is another version of central control. And initially, it was the young people. In this law, if you're 55 and older, you're the one that's paying for it. So they shifted it from the millennials to the people right before Medicare. 5-to-1 premium ratio, and that's the minimum. The insurance company can do whatever it wants. Who does that mean? It's crazy, isn't it?
Well, it's one of those things. It is and it isn't. For years, there has not been community ratings as far as the premiums, that when you were young, you paid very little because you were not likely to use it, really, unless you were in an auto accident, maybe got appendicitis. But generally speaking, the young people don't use the health insurance, and the older people do. So the question is, how do you make up for that? And that's one of the reasons why health savings accounts are a good idea, because if everybody starts saving money toward that possibility, and then you have an insurance policy that covers the hospital costs, which are the big costs, because the insurance market used to actually be pretty good.
I know, because it didn't cover everything.
Ago, I mean, I always had pay-as-you-go plus a catastrophic policy, and my whole career and being a self-employed person, I just thought, boy, this is a good opportunity, and it's easy enough to pay the doctor. Even mammograms were not very expensive, and they've kept mammograms very inexpensive, where almost anyone could afford to pay out of pocket. And get rid of a few Starbucks coffees, and you've paid for a mammogram. And it was just a couple $100 a month, and before the ACA came out, it was still just a couple $100 a month. And that's because most people do not have to use a catastrophic policy. And this is one of the things, when lawmakers are pulling all this together, they're just trying to go for emotional issues so they can get elected. think about it. Most people don't get sick. They live their lives, have some problem, and then they have a heart attack and die. And that's what happens to most people. So you're talking a percentage of people who, yes, of course they need insurance, but to make all these massive changes, like you allude to, sticking your finger on the scale for something that doesn't really need it, that have an array of insurance policies. Don't tell people they need essential health benefits. It's ridiculous. Yes, there should be some policies out there that cover maternity. No, the insurance companies aren't going to do it. They're in business, too. That's why they have motorcycle insurance. They have insurance for risky behaviors. You got to pay for it, but they have insurance for it. That's
exactly
what they're in the business of doing.
And it stratifies
and how insurance got started. Insurance for ships that were crossing the ocean. And which was a very risky business back then.
Mm-hmm.
And they lost a lot of money, but they knew there was money to be made by issuing policy. And that's the same thing that's going to happen with health. They know there's money to be made by doing it. And they will have a whole array of products. And all of them will. The little secret in the insurance business is that they all get together to make forms. So no matter what company you go to, you're going to have the same insurance form. And they're all going to get together and say, okay, well, let's have 9 different policies that everybody can pick from. And that would be a wonderful thing if they did that. And when the ACA first came out, it was, why would you make insurers have one policy? That was a recipe for disaster, and now we're seeing it.
On that note, let's take a break. You're listening to Medicine on Call. Welcome back to Medicine on Call.
Well, I thought they were supposed to be our representative.
Oh, hey, Dr. Singleton. Can you hear me?
Uh-huh.
Oh, I just wanted to go back to the health savings account and my take on it. You know, one of the things that I like the fact that she can save more money, but I want your opinion on this. One of the things I don't like about it is that you have to use it for insurance purposes. I mean, you can't use it for anything that you want to as an individual. You can't use it for direct primary care or medical tourism or anything that you deem that you want to use it for health-related reasons. To me, that's another giveaway to the insurance model. Why does everything become a sinkhole or catchment for them? Why can't people use their own minds to take care of themselves?
Well, you should still be able to use it for the over-the-counter medicine.
Yeah, but that's the only thing that's new about it.
Right.
But can you use it for supplements?
Because that's what you used to be able to take. And, in fact, I remember the drug company or the CVS, you know, the pharmacy places, used to star your receipt saying HSA eligible.
Mm-hmm.
And for the various over-the-counter drugs and stuff, and then the ACA stopped that. But you should be able to use it for anything. But part of the problem is, and this is ends up being the issue, is not trusting the populace for honesty, basically, because people would cheat. And then the question is, how much money do you actually lose for the cheaters versus the people who are using it? Because let's say you used it for medical tourism. Well, do you get a whole vacation in Thailand?
So?
Or, you know what I mean?
But it's your money. What makes it better for them to take your Social Security and use it for something else outside the Social Security lockbox?
Well,
I mean,
because they're the government. They can
oh, well, there
it.
You go.
The problem is you haven't paid tax on it. And the reason you didn't pay tax is because you were supposed to use it for your health, which ultimately saves the taxpayer money. So it all evens out. Because if you're healthy, you don't cost the taxpayer. But if you spend it on a vacation, that doesn't save the taxpayers any money. I mean, you can see the rationale that, and it's probably true, that if you take care of yourself, in the end, you save the taxpayer money.
True. But, you know, there's been articles coming out daily almost about how the medical research industry is completely bogus, and a lot of these studies that come out are completely untrue. And this evidence-based medicine side of it, where the insurance company is now in the business of practicing medicine because they have their internal, you know, panels that decide what constitutes medical necessity. You know, the pendulum swings the opposite way. Who stands to gain? Is it right for somebody who doesn't have your interest but a fiduciary responsibility to their investors? Is it right that they have more power than you over your own body and your own choices? That, I think that's the major question, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. It is. It is.
Well, I know what my answer is. Government shouldn't control my body or my mind or my pocketbook. That's my take on it.
Well, see, now I'll play the devil's advocate that, now, Dr. George, you're not the only person in this society that you have, we live in a citizenry and we have a social contract and we have to do things to make society as a whole work better. And one of the things you do to make society as a whole work better is contribute some of your money to their health care.
But, okay, I'm going to play devil's advocate back. If that were true and you were 80 years old and you needed your hip replaced and you were medically approved to do it, but it got denied because you were a senior and you lived a good life and you should be happy and just die, I take offense to that. And so you're not using my money in a way that helps everybody, are you? You're using it to help people who you deem are worthy. To me, that breaks the contract.
Well, you're absolutely right. And it's like, sorry, Charlie, I can't say the government deserves to say who lives and who dies and who was good and who was bad. I mean, you know, perhaps if you're in prison and you're paying a debt to society, that the government can control your life. Beyond that, it's like, don't decide that I'm not worth it. And this is what bothers me, because I look at Jimmy Carter, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, yep, who were quite ill, and they got care to the max. And I wonder if it were me at 85, would I be getting the same care? Or would I be told, get over it, go into hospice, and meet your maker?
I think I know, we both know the answer to that. And let's talk about the AHA, AHCA, and the fact that they block grant money back to the states for Medicaid. But what's really a little poison pill in that is it allows the states to withdraw some of these, or decide these essential benefits. And they use an example of maternity care and mental health. Now look, I'm not a big fan of, honestly, of these drugs that people get, you know, prescribed for various ailments. There's no proof that they work. I think they may do more harm than good. And I've been on the other side where I've been in the clinic and seen children come through on every neuroleptic drug you can name. I mean, they're like six on antipsychotics, antidepressants for ADHD, blah, blah, blah. So I'm not a fan. But what about the people who actually do need some help or need to get counseling or drug abuse treatment? Those are getting pulled from the Medicaid population. So for me, it has the possibility of worsening the two-tier system of care.
Well, that's right. And already, if you, again, when we start talking about health, you get into social issues and how social issues affect health. And let's mm-hmm. face it, if you're borderline mentally ill, and even if you're not homeless, even if you manage to pull enough together to live in a downtown hotel, most of which were taken away by gentrification anyway, mm-hmm. You're going to have more health problems. You're not going to address something. I mean, gee, working at San Francisco General, who did you see? You saw abscesses and things like this of folks that didn't have the sense to go in or the wherewithal. I mean, because it was free, so it wasn't a money issue. And they had little emergency hospitals all over the city. They were little satellite places.
Mm-hmm.
But they just didn't go because mentally they were not fit to go. And you've got all these people that need taking care of. And when you've got social issues that prevent people from seeking medical care, that has to be incorporated. What are you going to do about these folks? So you do need services for them, or else whatever their problem is going to get worse. They're going to end up in the ICU, and then they're going to end up costing $1 million rather than $15,000.
True.
So it and it's a tough call. Then where does that money go? When you put it to social services and call healthcare a social service issue, does that come from a quote-unquote healthcare law, or does it come from whatever the pot is for social services in any given city or state, and however their social service system happens to run? And different cities deal with these things in different ways. In San Diego, they have a huge homeless shelter because Joan Crock of McDonald's lived outside San Diego. And so she gave hordes of money to build a massive homeless shelter run by a Jesuit priest and has it totally staffed. But everybody doesn't have a Joan Crock who lives in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. So it's such a complex issue. But again, it comes back to what you were saying. This is one of the reasons, though, that it may be better to keep the government out of it. That for years, when you have charities running these things, they always seem to work better.
It's true.
And one thing, the people working there work there because they want to. And there are so many good government workers, but there are also government workers who realize that they'll never get fired, and they become lazy in their job.
When you're spending other people's money, it always becomes it's another level. On that note, let's take a small break. You're listening to Medicine On Call.
Health insurance was the promise of Obamacare. But for many, the government mandate caused more problems than it solved. This is Dr. Elena George from Medicine on Call, and I want to tell you about a truly affordable alternative allowed under Obamacare, Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare bypasses doctor and hospital panels, giving you the freedom to choose. And with a maximum of $500 out-of-pocket per person and 100% coverage up to $1 million per year per occurrence, you can rest assured knowing you and your family are protected. Coverage starts as low as $107 per month and also includes dental, vision, pharmacy, and holistic care. Liberty HealthShare puts you back in charge of your health. Visit them online at libertyoncall.org. Again, for a true affordable alternative to Obamacare, visit libertyoncall.org or call toll-free 1-800-714-6993 today.
Welcome back to Medicine on Call. Hey, Dr. Singleton, I have a quick question for you now about if you could run this and you could fix this. My take personally is, you know, there's only maybe 5% of people who really do have catastrophic health problems like you described. They're not the majority. Wouldn't it just be easier to put them in Medicare and be done with it? Wouldn't that be cheaper?
It probably would. One of the things that they've done, that there's a law that's been proposed, which to me sounds like a good one and a slam dunk, is, you know, if you become disabled, there's a 2-year waiting period to get on Medicare, and this is just to let cancer people waive the 2-year waiting period, which makes sense because they'll be dead by the time the 2 years is up,
right?
And let them get on Medicare. And it would be interesting if that passes to say, okay, now how does that work? And let's look at the numbers. Apparently, only 115,000 people in the U.S. took part in the high-risk pool So that's not very many people.
No.
At all. And let's say that number is off by 100%. So you still end up with only 250,000 people extra. And it probably would be easier than continually trying to manipulate the insurance market.
And make every and price everybody out. And
right.
I would love to also see the parameters for being eligible change. You basically have to give up everything to become eligible. You have to sell your property. You have to be destitute. You have to use your savings. What happens when you survive the illness? You've got nothing. That makes
right.
no sense to me.
Right. And, I had this discussion with an older single woman about this, talking about taking the money away from the spouse. And as a woman married to a man who has the likelihood of dying before me, I really object to them taking 100%. You know, that the deeming has to go all the way down to the $2,000. And you can keep your house, but getting rid of all the money. So then it's all spent on the husband, and then mm-hmm. the wife has nothing.
And so you've just created a social issue, a problem.
You know, so yet another thing that pops up when you try to do all this. And I think the whole criteria thing is a whole nother conversation mm-hmm. because look at the whole disability fraud mm-hmm. and what happened during the recession when unemployment was way up. What went up? Disability claims that so people could get some income from disability that they would have normally gotten from unemployment. So what do you do about all this? And you can't assume that a citizen is a liar. And that's basically what you have to do if you start having draconian disability rules, because mm-hmm. there are people who have valid disabilities. But there's also people who are malingerers. And how do you separate them out in a huge system where you'd have to have a social worker on every corner to go in and evaluate, et cetera? And that costs money. Everything costs money.
True. But one of the conversations that we're not having and that hasn't been had in the entire reform effort is, why does it cost so much? How are the hospitals getting away with facility fees and 10, 15, 20 times more than what it costs going as opposed to going to an independent doctor? The insurance companies are in cahoots with this because it makes them seem valuable. If it's a $6,000 ER visit for nothing, and the insurance company becomes the best game in town because you need them, because you can't afford it on your own. Where's the effort to rein in and to really, I don't see any congressional hearings on why it costs you so much money to have, you look at two equal procedures and labs, et cetera. Why is it so much money in the insurance-based system versus the cash-based system?
You almost answer it with your own question, because they're getting the money, and if they set the prices. Well, look at this whole thing, these hospital charge master lists of the pricing that insurance companies pay, that they charge to the insurer, versus pricing that you can get if you're a self-pay person. So automatically, the charge master price, sometimes it's three times the amount of what the actual cost of the service is. Now, the hospital's answer to that is, you need the higher prices from the insurer to pay for the charity care.
Oh, please.
You have to jack up the prices to pay for people like the housekeeping services that do not generate any income. Okay, so this is the justification for having the high prices.
And
I didn't make them. I'm only telling you what they say. don't
shoot the messenger. Well, how do you justify the CEO of these places making, millions and bonuses and the growth of the hospital. I mean, every hospital in Georgia, in Atlanta, has basically grown and has a new brand spanking new facility. Where's that money coming from? If they're so poor, how are they affording 50 flat screen TVs in the OR, hospital I used to be on staff at? Two flat screen TVs per OR and in the hallway. Complete waste of money. Unnecessary. Where's this money coming from? And they are getting paid for indigent care because the government pays for it, doesn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Some of it. Some of it. Now, in California, we have a tobacco tax. Cigarettes are, I don't know, have $4 a pack tax. And the tobacco tax is supposed to help pay for indigent care. And, of course, it doesn't, and nobody ever sees it. And one of the things they do, and this is something that doesn't come out in the conversation, as soon as a patient who is impoverished for one reason or another comes in, the admission social worker tries to interview them or the family or whatever to find out if they qualify for Medicaid.
Mm-hmm.
And then they can retroactively be put on Medicaid for that hospital admission. And so people, interestingly, there's people who slip through the cracks of their own volition. I've heard patients say, oh, well, I don't want charity, but then they don't pay the hospital bill anyway, so they missed out on an opportunity to never see another medical bill in their life, you know, because they don't understand the system. And perhaps that's what we really need to do, is teach healthcare policy in high school so people understand the system. Because I really don't think they understand what's out there, how it works, what the pricing is. And I think once people understood,
mm-hmm.
they would welcome cash practices and catastrophic insurance only when they see how much it raises the prices by having a system where you have the insurer just injected into every aspect of the medical care.
Yeah, from the first dollar in some instances. Mm-hmm. You know, I know that when you started the show, we talked about how one of the pundits thought it was going to be a slippery slope to single payer. And I believe that as well. I think we're now fast-tracked. If this thing passes, which I'm not sure that it will, because it looks like the Senate is going to write their own bill. And I read that yesterday they're looking at keeping the taxes of Obamacare in because they need to fund it, quote unquote. So I don't know, you know, if this is even going to happen. But let's say it does. And they are able to pass this House bill into law. There are going to be so many unhappy people paying more money than they ever thought they would have to pay. And especially taxes from the state level and the federal level and the people in the middle, the working class as usual, and the working poor and the seniors, the people before Medicare. I shouldn't even say seniors because I'm in this group now. But the people who are not eligible for Medicare, they're the ones who are going to be footing the bill. And a lot of people on the upper end of the pay scale, $200,000 and above, are getting tax breaks, apparently. If you look at how it's configured, they're going to be clamoring for the government to fix it. And when they fix it, you know they're coming with single payer, right?
Right.
And I think it's already, this is the infrastructure of single payer. They've already done it to doctors with the accountable care, meaningful use, having the hospitals become the baseline of health care because they've purchased a lot of independent doctors. They're the biggest game in town. You've got the insurance companies getting every single conceivable funding source coming to them, whether it be by subsidy, by the mandate of 30% surcharge, health savings account. And when this thing collapses, my take on it is that the insurance companies will be positioned to become the advantage plans. So just like Medicare Advantage, they'll become the administrator for the rest of the healthcare system, the commercial side. And then you got single payer by default. I don't think it's going to look like England. I don't think it's going to look like Canada. It'll be a corporate, rigid structure where they get to control the first dollar to the end and then decide, care, who gets it, and who, you know, they get to decide everything.
Well, the insurers are already positioned for that in the sense that people might notice if they have Medicare that when they get the explanation of benefits from Medicare, it comes from an insurer, sometimes Blue Cross.
Right.
Blue Cross usually, and I've been in Maryland, California, Massachusetts, run the Medicare program. It's not like the government runs it as such. The government funds it.
Right.
And then the private insurer is a third-party administrator for it. So they're already set up for that. And they're the ones who kind of funnel the paperwork and all this sort of thing. So they're there already.
They are. And the Medicare Advantage plans were costing Medicare more money than straight Medicare, if I recall correctly. You know,
right.
So, you know, you inserted something that creates its own value, takes its administrative fee, makes money on both ends because the government pays it, and then it decides what it's going to cover. You know, so, I mean, you get to double dip, and you get to practice medicine. You know, I think that this could be, if I were running it again, I would make the insurance companies bear the risk. Right now, they can do whatever they want. If you have a bad outcome, so what? The doctor gets sued. In my opinion, one thing that could change this thing on a dime would be if you have a bad outcome and your insurance company denied you care based on their internal metrics, but it didn't meet the standard of your medical society. You know, if you anesthesia has a standard of care, ENT. If I'm supposed to be able to do that as a physician based on my society's guidelines, but the insurance companies are different, and you have a bad outcome, the insurance company's on the hook, and they get sued. Don't you think that would change the paradigm very quickly?
Well, actually, many moons ago in California, there was a lawsuit that was quite similar to that, and that ended up creating the Department of Managed Care and the Knox-Keene Act, and there are certain things that these managed care entities have to do, and it started off with just appointments, and I'll never forget once I couldn't get an appointment with my doctor. It was just a routine physical, and it was way out in the ether, and I said, well, you know the Knox-Keene Act says you have to be able to see your doctor within 6 weeks of the phone call, and boy, did they find an appointment. It's one of those things, again, this is why I think people should have a class in healthcare, because I'm sure a lot of states have similar rules and things, mm-hmm. but people don't know what they are, so they don't invoke them when they can. And so people kind of get away with it. And you know that that's the case in so many things. My husband and I laugh about senior discounts that very few places are going to tell you that they have one, but if you ask, they always have one. So you have to learn to speak up.
True.
But if you don't know what to speak up for, then you're not going to, because there are many a rule like that. But in any event, and there was a suit just with regard to denial of benefits, and basically it was interpreting the contract language, and so the patient won. Now, I'm sure the insurers changed the contract language to be less ambiguous, but they still say medical necessity, which ends up being a vague standard. Is it necessary when the insurer says it's necessary, or when Dr. Elena George says it's necessary?
I think that most doctors and patients don't fight it. I mean, there's a physicians organizing committee based in California, and their whole job is to be an advocate for the doctor and fighting the insurance companies on these points. And they're volunteers, believe it or not, who have just want to be an advocate for both the doctor and the patient. It took 2 years to get paid on one surgery that I did based on them going to the contract and saying, this is by your own letter of your own contract. You have to pay this. And it took, I can't even tell you how many rounds of appeal, but we finally got it. But most doctors don't do that. And most patients don't know that they can do that. And it really does, you're right, come down to educating yourself and not just taking what people say is gospel as gospel, especially when it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense for these facility fees. What's going on with that? How do you justify tacking on a surcharge for a piece of equipment that you already own? I mean, how much money do they need to make off of people?
Well, but you need the technician to run the piece of equipment that you already own. My goodness, don't you know that? Goodness.
It's not a little piddly amount, though. It's like thousands of dollars for a facility fee.
It's very, very interesting because I had referred a patient to an ophthalmologist for her droopy eyes. I mean, and they really were droopy, not just a plastic surgery thing. She could barely see.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, be prepared. She'll give you a list of four places she goes. And one of the reasons she goes these four different places is the facility fee that she says you might not want to go all the way down to Fremont, but their facility fee is only X number of dollars, whereas the one in Walnut Creek has a $1,000 facility fee. You know, so this facility fee, obviously, if each institution can have such a wide variation in facility fee,
mm-hmm. It
lets you know it's more like it's a slush fund, that they have priced something else lower, and because it's some sort of a loss leader, and then they make up the difference with the facility fee.
Well, when you can go to an independent, freestanding facility and not pay a facility fee, and everything's rolled into one price for the time you walk in to the time you leave, you know, it boggles the mind, honestly. But I think patients need to become healthcare consumers, honestly. It's on them. Because if you expect the government at this point to take care of you and to have your interest, you've already stated multiple times, they think you're going to lie, cheat, and you're not worthy. And they know what's better. You've said that. Why would you want somebody or some entity to have control over you like that? I'm not a criminal. I don't appreciate being treated like one.
And they treat the doctors like criminals and the patients like criminals. It's like the default mindset is that both of you are cheaters trying to get something you don't deserve.
Exactly.
And once you start that mindset, you know that it's not going to end well.
Yes, that's very succinctly stated. Agreed. But the people who are writing these laws are not squeaky clean. You know, this is, you know, pot calling kettle. These people are the worst. I mean, they have all sorts of conflict of interests. And the fact that they get money given to them for their campaigns from the same people that they're writing laws in favor of, is there not a problem with that?
There's such a problem with that. And the sad thing is it comes out, this is what really bothers me, yet people vote for these creatures over and over again.
Yeah.
This is what amazes me, is I remember when that fellow down in Louisiana was caught with $90,000 in his freezer.
I remember that.
You know, he's reelected. Marion Barry, who was caught smoking crack, he's reelected. You know, it's strange to me that people who were caught in the act, very horrible acts, are reelected. But
sure. You can't even argue that point. I totally agree with that. But then the flip side of it is everybody seems to be tainted. Anybody who's decent can't get funded. You know, they don't have an ability to get out there and get their name, you know, advertised. They don't have the money to do it. So you end up creating the same creatures, they just change their stripes. That's why I think, you know, the whole two-party system is completely corrupt, because they're both funded by the same people on both sides.
Oh, right. My husband and I say that all the time. They're just two sides of the same coin.
Totally.
And
agree.
I do think that that's what made someone like Trump get some traction. It was almost like he could have said anything, but it was the idea that he was an outsider. Look at France. Both the two top people on the ticket were two outsiders.
Well, actually, the one who won wasn't. He just said he was. I mean, he was far from it, actually. And that whole election, not to change the subject, but that was a study in, my God, what did they do? They destroyed ballots. They totally rigged that thing. I think she was going to be arrested. You know, even if she got elected, they're going to arrest her for some campaign shenanigans. You know, they're saying that she used money for a bodyguard or some ridiculousness.
Right, right.
That thing
right.
was really a study in, you want the status quo, you're going to have the status quo no matter what, and this is what you get. We actually bucked the system on ours. But I wonder how long, you know, I have question marks about how it's rolling out. I think most people do. Whether you're on the left side or the right side, no one can be really happy about the way the government is running. It's dysfunctional. It's weird. I mean, what's going on, how Congress is behaving, I just have an issue with it.
Again, this is what I wonder. People will say that, but then vote the same congressperson right back in.
It's true. We've had the same congressperson for about 30 years, or we are. I'm sure you guys have the same.
And that's pretty much the case. The percent is 93% of incumbents are voted in. And generally, the only way you can get a new person in is if the incumbent retires, so you've got two new folks running against each other.
Or they die and then their spouse gets in. I don't understand that either.
One of the things, and it's how my old congressperson got in, the congressperson she was working for retired in April, so they had to have a special election, and the special election drew about 20-some thousand people because nobody really knew about it. So that's a person. No, these are all the tricks of the trade. You know, obviously, if he was on the up and up, he would have finished out his term so it came up in the regular election cycle where people would have campaigned and whatnot.
Yeah.
It was just like, okay, let's have a pro forma election and we'll pop this name in. And then voila, you become the new congressperson, not a dollar spent.
It's amazing. All sorts of drama. Hey, in the minute that we have left, how can people reach you? And how can they read what you've been writing? Because it's always just pearls of wisdom.
Oh, thank you. At aapsonline.org. And there's all sorts of articles and information for patients, and it is one way to start learning about the system, and there's actually a link on there for patients. And it, excuse me, it also has lists of doctors who are outside the system and have cash-only practices, and they all tend to charge less money, magically.
Imagine that. Oh, yeah, I always love to have you on my show. I learn so much, and you just say it in such a way that's so relatable. It's not about heat. It's about information. And everybody should go to the website, aapsonline.org, and read the new blog that you put out about the healthcare bill that's been introduced. And I can't wait to have you back on the show again in the future.
Well, thank you for having me. Always a pleasure.
Have a wonderful day. You too. Have a wonderful day. Bye-bye. Thank you for listening to Medicine on Call.
Revolutionary Talk for Revolutionary Times. Liberty Talk FM.